he did. Wellington is classic warfare getting its revenge. In his heyday, Bonaparte had come across this in Italy and defeated it superbly. The old owl had fled before the young vulture. Age-old tactics had not only been roundly trounced, but outraged. Who was this 26-year-old Corsican? What did this splendid ignoramus mean when, with everyone against him, no one for him, without provisions, without munitions, without cannons, without shoes, almost without an army, with a handful of men against masses, he ran at Allied Europe and carried absurd, impossible victories against all the odds? Where did he come from, this thundering maniac who, almost without stopping for breath, and with the same pack of combatants as the only hand he could play, had pulverized one after another the five armies of the Emperor of Germany, hurling Beaulieu back at Alvinzi, Wurmser at Beaulieu, Melas at Wurmser, Mack at Melas? Who was this newcomer to war, this little upstart with the effrontery of a star? The military academe excommunicated him as it went under. Hence the implacable rancor of the old Caesarism against the new, of the ordinary saber against the flamboyant sword, and of the chessboard against sheer genius. On June 18th, 1815, this rancor had the last word, and below Lodi, Montebello, Montenotte, Mantua, Marengo, Arcola, it wrote, Waterloo. The triumph of mediocrity that the majority loves. Destiny let the irony pass. At his decline, Napoleon found himself facing another young Wurmser. For to get Wurmser, all you have to do, in fact, is to whiten Wellington's hair. Waterloo is a battle of the first order, won by a captain of the second. What has to be admired in the Battle of Waterloo is England. English steadfastness, English resolution, English blood. The superb thing that England had going for it there, whether it likes it or not, was itself, not its captain, its army. Wellington, oddly ungrateful, declares in a letter to Lord Bathurst that his army, the army that did battle on June 18, 1815, was a despicable army. What does that grisly pile of mixed bones buried beneath the furrows of Waterloo make of that, I wonder? England has been too modest in relation to Wellington. To make so much of Wellington is to make too little of England. Wellington is just a hero, like any other. The Scottish Greys, the Horse Guards, the regiments of Maitland and of Mitchell, the infantry of Pack and of Kempt, the cavalry of Ponsonby and of Somerset, the Highlanders playing bagpipes under fire, the battalions of Ryland, the fresh-faced recruits who barely knew how to handle a musket holding out against the old hands of Essling and Rivoli, that is what is great. Wellington was tenacious, that was his merit, and we don't want to take that away from him, but the least of his foot soldiers or horsemen was every bit as rock-solid as he was. The Iron Soldier is worth every bit as much as the Iron Duke. As for us, we attribute all glory to the English soldier, to the English army, to the English people. If there is to be a trophy, it is to the English people that it should go. The Waterloo Column would be more just if, instead of the figure of a man, it raised to the skies the statue of a people. But this mighty England would be offended by what we are saying here. Even after its 1688 and our 1789, it still has feudal illusions. It believes in heredity and in hierarchy. This people, whom no one else surpasses in power and glory, esteems itself a nation, not a people. As a people, it willingly knuckles under and accepts a lord as its leader. A working man lets himself be treated with contempt. A soldier lets himself be bludgeoned. We recall that at the Battle of Inkerman, a sergeant who apparently had saved the army could not be mentioned by Lord Raglan, the English military hierarchy not allowing any hero below the grade of officer to be cited in a report. What we admire above all in an encounter of the kind that took place at Waterloo is the tremendous cunning of chance. Overnight rain, the wall of Hougoumont, the hollow road of Ohain, Grouchy deaf to cannon fire, Napoleon's guide deceiving him, Bülow's guide enlightening him, the whole cataclysm was conducted with consummate skill. On the whole, we have to say, Waterloo was more of a massacre than a battle. Of all pitched battles, Waterloo is the one with the smallest front in relation to the number of combatants. Napoleon, 2 miles. Wellington, 1.5 miles. 72,000 combatants on each side. The carnage stems from such density. The sums have been done and this ratio established. Loss of men at Austerlitz, French 14%, Russians 30%, Austrians 44%. At Wagram, French 13%, Austrians 14%. At Moscow, French 37%, Russians 44%. At Bautzen, French 13%, Russians and Prussians 14%. At Waterloo, French 56%, Allies 31%. Average for Waterloo, 41%. 144,000 men. 60,000 dead. The field of Waterloo today looks like any other plain. It has that calm that belongs to the earth as mankind's impassive support. At night, though, a sort of visionary mist emanates from it. And if a traveller should stroll around there and look and listen and dream like Virgil before the fatal plain of Philippi, he is seized by a hallucination of the disaster. That terrible June 18th lives on. The artificial hill monument fades from view. The nondescript lion evaporates. The battlefield resumes its reality. Lines of infantry snake across the plain. Furious galloping stirs up the horizon. The startled dreamer sees the lightning flash of sabers, the glint of bayonets, the blazing of bursting shells, the monstrous crossfire of thunderbolts. He hears the dim clamor of the phantom battle, like a death rattle from the depths of the grave. These shades are the grenadiers. These gleams are cuirassiers. This skeleton is Napoleon. That skeleton is Wellington. All this is no more, and yet the slaughter continues. And the ravines run red with blood, and the trees shiver, and the fury rises up to the skies. And in the darkness, all these wild and wind-blasted heights, Mont-Saint-Jean, Hougomont, Frischemont, Papelotte, Planchenoit, appear crowned by blurry whirlpools of spectres exterminating each other. Do we have to think Waterloo was a good thing? There exists a very respectable liberal school that does not abhor Waterloo. We do not subscribe to it. For us, Waterloo is merely the amazing birth of liberty. That such an eagle should emerge from such an egg is surely unexpected. Waterloo, if you look at it in terms of its ultimate outcome, is a deliberate counter-revolutionary victory. It is Europe versus France. It is Petersburg, Berlin, and Vienna versus Paris. It is the status quo versus initiative. It is July 14, 1789, attacked via March 20, 1815. It is the pandemonium of the monarchies versus the indomitable French riot. To finally extinguish this vast people that had been in eruption for 26 years, that was the dream. Solidarity of the Brunswicks, the Nassaus, the Romanovs, the Hohenzollerns, the Habsburgs with the Bourbons. Waterloo carries divine right in the passenger seat. It is true that the empire having been despotic, royalty, as a natural reaction, had no choice but to be liberal, and that a reluctant constitutional order has sprung from Waterloo to the great regret of the victors. The fact is that revolution cannot really be defeated and that, being providential and absolutely inevitable, it always reappears. Before Waterloo, in Bonaparte's tearing down the old thrones. After Waterloo, in Louis XVIII's granting the charter and abiding by it. Bonaparte places a coachman on the throne of Naples and a sergeant on the throne of Sweden, using inequality to demonstrate equality. Louis XVIII, at Saint-Ouen, countersigns the Declaration of the Rights of Man. If you want to understand what revolution is, call it progress. And if you want to understand what progress is, call it tomorrow. Tomorrow does its work irresistibly, and it does it starting today. It always achieves its aim, strangely. It puts Wellington to work to turn Foy, who was a mere soldier, into an orator. Foy falls wounded at Hougoumont and gets back on his feet at the rostrum. That is how progress works. No tool is wrong for this particular labor. It adapts to its divine labor without being put off. Both the man who bounded over the Alps and the poor doddering old invalid of Father Élisée. It makes use of the gout sufferer as it does of the conqueror. The conqueror outside France, the gout sufferer inside. In cutting short the demolition of the European thrones by the sword, Waterloo had no other effect than to keep up the work of revolution by other means. The swordsmen have finished. It is the thinker's turn. The century that Waterloo tried to put an end to walked all over it and went on its way. This sinister victory has been defeated by liberty. Briefly and incontestably, what triumphed at Waterloo, what smiled behind Wellington, what brought him all the batons of the marshals of Europe, including, they say, the baton of the Maréchal de France, what gleefully wheeled in barrows of dirt and bones to build the Lion's Knoll, what triumphantly wrote on the pedestal the date June 18, 1815, what encouraged Blücher as he hacked into the rout, what from the height of the plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean looked down over France as though looking down over some prey, was the counter-revolution. It was the counter-revolution that mumbled that infamous word, dismemberment. Reaching Paris, it saw the crater from close up. It felt the ashes burning its feet and had second thoughts. It reverted to stammering about a charter. Let us see Waterloo for what it is, and nothing more. A deliberate bid for liberty? Not at all. The counter-revolution was unintentionally liberal, the same way that, through a corresponding phenomenon, Napoleon was unintentionally revolutionary. On June 18, 1815, Robespierre on horseback was thrown from the saddle. A fresh bout of divine right. It was the end of the dictatorship, and with it, a whole European system fell apart. The empire faded to a shadow that resembled that of the dying Roman world. An abyss opened up again as in the days of the barbarians. Only the barbarism of 1815, which should be called by its pet name, the counter-revolution, lacked stamina, soon ran out of puff and pulled up short. The empire, we must admit, was cried over and cried over by heroic eyes. If there is glory in the sword turned scepter, the empire had been glory itself. It had spread over the earth all the light that tyranny can provide. A somber light. We might even go so far as to say a dark light. Compared to the light of day, it is night. The disappearance of the night had the effect of an eclipse. Louis XVIII returned to Paris. The going round in circles of July 8th obliterated the zeal of March 20th. The Corsican became the antithesis of the man from the Bayonne. The flag on the dome of the Tuileries was white. Exile sat in state on the throne. Hartwell's pinewood card table took up position in front of Louis XIV's fleur-de-lis-patterned armchair. People talked about Bouvines and Fontenoy as yesterday's news, Austerlitz being entirely out of date. The altar and the throne fraternized majestically. One of the most uncontested forms of salvation of 19th-century society set itself up in France and on the continent. Europe wore the white cockade. Trestaillon became a celebrity. The saying non pluribus impar cropped up again in the stone rays representing a sunburst on the façade of the Quai d'Orsay barracks. Where there had been the Imperial Guard, there was now a Maison Rouge. The Arc du Carousel, completely loaded with ill-gotten victories, feeling out of place among all these novelties, and a bit ashamed, perhaps, of Marengo and Arcola, saved face with a statue of the Duc d'Angoulême. The cemetery of the Madeleine, that terrible potter's field of 93, was covered over with marble and jasper, since the bones of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette were in that dust. In the moat of Vincennes, a monumental pillar rose out of the ground, recalling the fact that the Duc d'Enghien had died in the very same month Napoleon had been crowned. Pope Pius VII, who performed this coronation hot on the heels of that death, calmly blessed the fall as he had blessed the rise. There was in Schönbrunn Castle a little shadow 4 years old whom it was seditious to call the King of Rome. And these things were done, and those kings took their thrones back, and the master of Europe was thrown in a cage, and the old regime became the new regime, and all the light and all the shadow of the earth swapped places, all because one summer afternoon a shepherd boy had said to a Prussian in a wood, "Go this way, not that." This 1815 was a gloomy sort of spring. The old unhealthy and poisonous realities decked themselves out in new appearances. Dishonesty espoused 1789, divine right hid itself behind a charter, fictions made themselves constitutional, prejudices, superstitions, and ulterior motives, taking Article 14 to heart, cloaked themselves in liberalism. The snakes shed their skins. Man had been both aggrandized and belittled at once by Napoleon. The ideal, under this reign of material splendor, went by the strange name of ideology that was bestowed upon it. It was serious recklessness on the part of a great man to scoff at the future. Yet the people, that cannon fodder so in love with the cannoneer, looked around for him. Where is he? What is he doing? "Napoleon is dead," said a passer-by to one of the war-wounded from Marengo and Waterloo. "Him dead?" cried the soldier. "That's how well you know him." People's imaginations defied this man struck down. The heart of Europe after Waterloo was black. Something enormous remained empty for a long time when Napoleon vanished. The kings threw themselves into the vacuum. Old Europe took advantage of it to reform itself. There was a holy alliance, the Belle Alliance that the fatal field of Waterloo foretold. In the face of this antique Europe reformed, the outlines of a new France took shape. The future, scorned by the emperor, made its entrance. It had plastered on its forehead that star, liberty. The ardent eyes of the younger generations turned toward it. What was strange was that they fell in love with both the future, liberty, and the past, Napoleon, at the same time. The defeat had magnified the defeated out of all proportion. Bonaparte, fallen, seemed taller than Napoleon on his feet. Those who had triumphed took fright. England had him guarded by Hudson Lowe, and France had him spied on by Montchigny. His folded arms became the terror of thrones. Alexander called him "my insomnia." This fear stemmed from the whiff of revolution he had about him, which explains and excuses Bonapartist liberalism. This phantom made the old world quake in its boots. The kings reigned uncomfortably, with the Rock of St. Helena on the horizon. While Napoleon lay dying at Longwood, the 60,000 men fallen in the field of Waterloo quietly rotted away, and something of their peacefulness spread over the world. The Congress of Vienna made the treaties of 1815 out of it, and Europe called this the Restoration. So that is what Waterloo is. But what does that matter to eternity? That whole tempest, that whole cloud, the war and after it the peace, the whole shadow play, did not darken for a moment the gleam of the immense eye before which an aphid hopping from one blade of grass to another is equal to the eagle flying from spire to spire among the towers of Notre Dame. The Battlefield by Night. Let's go back, it is a requirement of this book, to that fatal field of battle. On June 18, 1815, there was a full moon. The brightness favored Blücher's ferocious pursuit, gave away the traces of those fleeing, delivered that hopeless mass to the bloodthirsty Prussian cavalry, and aided and abetted the massacre. night sometimes enters into such tragic collaboration with disasters. When the last cannonball had been fired, the plain of Mont-Saint-Jean remained deserted. The English occupied the French camp, it being the usual observance of victory to sleep in the bed of the vanquished. They set up their bivouac on the other side of Rossomme. The Prussians, let loose on the fugitives, drove on. Wellington went into the village of Waterloo to draft his report to Lord Bathurst. If ever the sic vos non vobis was applicable, it surely is to the village of Waterloo. Waterloo did not do a thing, and it was 2 miles from the action. Mont-Saint-Jean was shelled, Hougoumont was set on fire, Papelotte was set on fire, Planchenoit was set on fire. La Haie Sainte was stormed, La Belle Alliance saw the two victors embrace, yet these names are scarcely known, and Waterloo, which played no role in the battle, takes all the credit for it. We are not among those who flatter war. When the occasion arises, we say what we think of it to its face. War can be appallingly beautiful, and we have not tried to hide this. It can also be, I think we all agree, somewhat ugly. One of its surprisingly ugly aspects is the prompt stripping of the dead after victory. The dawn that follows a battle always rises over bare corpses. Who does this? Who so tarnishes triumph? Whose is the vile hand that furtively slips into victory's pocket? Who are these crooks on the job behind glory's back? Some philosophers, Voltaire among them, assert that it is precisely these people who make glory what it is. They are the same people, they say. There are no extras. Those still standing loot those lying on the ground. The hero by day is the vampire by night. After all, a person has the right to rob a corpse he has made. As for us, we do not think so. For the same hand to gather laurels and steal a dead man's shoes seems inconceivable to us. What is certain is that, normally, after the victors come the thieves. But let's exonerate the soldier, particularly the contemporary soldier, from such a charge. Every army has a rear end, and that is where the accusation should lie. Being like bats, part brigand, part valet, every species of rodent engendered by this twilight we call war, wearers of uniforms who do not fight, would-be malingerers, dreadful walking wounded, shady canteen attendants trotting along on little carts, sometimes with their wives, stealing things they later sell on. Beggars offering themselves as guides to officers. Scum, marauders. Once upon a time, we are not speaking of the present day, armies on the march dragged all that straggling along, so much so that these camp followers are known in the trade as stragglers. No army or nation was responsible for these creatures. They spoke Italian and followed the Germans. They spoke French and followed the English. It was by one of these miserable wretches, a Spanish camp follower who spoke French, that the Marquis de Fervaques, hoodwinked by the man's Picard gobbledygook and so taking him for one of ours, was treacherously killed and robbed on the battlefield itself, on the night that followed the victory of Cerizol. From looting, the looter was born. The hateful maxim, live off your enemy, produced that leper that only strong discipline could cure. There are reputations that deceive. We don't always know why certain generals, and great ones at that, have been so popular. Turenne was adored by his soldiers because he tolerated pillaging. Allowing wrongdoing is part of being good-hearted. Turenne was so good-hearted, he let the Palatinate be put to the fire and to the sword. You used to see more or fewer marauders tagging along behind armies, depending on whether the chief was more or less strict. Hoche and Marceau had no camp followers. Wellington, we gladly do him this justice, had few. But on the night of June 18th and 19th, they stripped the dead clean. Wellington was firm, and the order was to put to death anyone caught in the act. But plunder is tenacious. The marauders flew off to one corner of the battlefield, while they were being shot in another. The moonlight was sinister on that particular plain. Around midnight, a man was prowling, or rather creeping, along the sunken Ouen road. To all appearances, he was one of those people we have just described, neither English nor French, neither peasant nor soldier, less man than ghoul, attracted by a nose for the dead, having theft for victory and coming to raid Waterloo. He was dressed in a smock that looked a bit like a greatcoat. He was both anxious and audacious. He crept forward but kept looking around behind him as he went. What was this man? The night probably knew more about him than the day. He didn't have any kind of bag, but obviously had big pockets under his greatcoat. Now and again he stopped, studied the plain around him as though to see if he were being observed, suddenly crouched down, poked around something quiet and motionless on the ground, then stood up again and scuttled away. His slithering, his bearing, his mysterious darting movements caused him to resemble those crepuscular specters that haunt ruins and that old Norman legends call allures, goers. Certain nocturnal wading birds make similar silhouettes in the wetlands. A gaze attentively probing all the mist might have noticed at a distance, standing still and as though hidden behind a shack alongside the Nivelle Road, where it meets the road from Mont-Saint-Jean to Braine-l'Alleud, a sort of small settler's wagon with a tarred wickerwork cover, hitched to a starving nag grazing on nettles through her bit, and in this wagon a woman of some kind sitting on top of trunks and parcels. Maybe there was some connection between the wagon and the prowler. The darkness was serene, not a cloud in the sky. Too bad if the earth was red, the moon remained white regardless. Such is the indifference of the heavens. In the meadows, branches of trees broken by gunfire, but not broken off, were hanging on by their bark and swaying gently in the night breeze. A breath, almost like sighing, stirred the undergrowth. There were ripples in the grass, like souls departing. You could dimly hear in the distance the coming and going of patrols and the circling watchmen of the English camp. Hougoumont and La Haie Sainte continued to burn, sending up two great flames, one in the west, one in the east, to which the ring of fires of the English bivouac, laid out in an immense semicircle over the hills along the horizon, had just linked up like a loosened ruby necklace with two red garnets at each end. We've talked about the disaster of the Ohain path. What that death was like for so many brave men, the heart is too appalled to dwell on. If anything is terrifying, if there is a reality that surpasses dream, it is this: to live, to see the sun, to be in full possession of manly vigor, to be full of health and joy, to laugh valiantly, to run toward the glory in front of you, dazzling, to feel in your chest lungs that breathe, a heart that beats, a will that reasons, to speak, to think, to love, to have a mother, to have a wife, to have children, to have the light. And all of a sudden, in the time it takes to let out a cry, in less than 1 minute flat, to tumble into an abyss, to fall, to roll, to crush, to be crushed, to see the blades of wheat, flowers, leaves, branches, and yet not be able to stop yourself by grabbing any of them, to feel your saber useless, men underneath you, horses on top of you, to flail about in vain, your bones broken by some kick in the dark, to feel a heel making your eyes pop out of your head, to bite into horseshoes with rage, to suffocate, to howl, to twist yourself in knots, to be at the bottom of all this, and tell yourself, just now, I was one of the living. Where this lamentable disaster had resounded with its death rattle, everything was now silent. The cutting made by the sunken road was filled up with horses and riders all inextricably jumbled. Horrific entanglement. The embankment was no more. Dead bodies made the road level with the plain right to the very edge, like a perfectly measured bushel of barley. A pile of dead men on the top, a river of blood on the bottom. That is what the road was like on the night of June 18, 1815. The blood ran right up to the Nivelle Road and welled up there in a huge pool in front of the felled trees that blocked the road at a spot still marked today. It is, as you will recall, at the opposite spot, going toward the Genappe Road, that the cuirassier collapsed. The density of corpses was in proportion to the depth of the sunken road. Round about the halfway mark, at the spot where it became a plain, where Delors' division had passed, the layer of dead men thinned out a bit. The night prowler the reader has just caught a glimpse of was headed that way. He was ferreting through that vast grave. He looked around. We don't know what hideous review of the dead he passed. He was walking with his feet in the blood. All of a sudden he stopped in his tracks. A few feet in front of him, in the sunken road, at the spot where the mound of the dead ended, from underneath this heap of men and horses, an open hand emerged, lit up by the moon. The hand had something on its finger that shone. It was a gold ring. The man bent down, staying crouching a moment, and when he stood up again, there was no more ring on the hand. He didn't exactly stand up again. He stayed in a half-crouching position, like that of a scared wildcat, turning his back on the heap of dead, scrutinizing the skyline, on his knees, the whole top part of his body being supported by his two index fingers on the ground, his head peering over the rim of the sunken road. The four paws of the jackal are just right for certain purposes. When he had set his course, he stood up. At that instant, he nearly jumped out of his skin. He could feel someone grab him from behind. He wheeled round. The open hand had closed again, seizing the lapel of his greatcoat. An honest man would have taken fright. This man burst out laughing. "I'll be damned," he said. "It's only the dead man. I prefer a ghost to a gendarme any day." But the hand relaxed and released him. Effort is quickly exhausted in the grave. "God," the prowler went on, "can this dead man be alive? Let's have a closer look." He bent down again, fumbled in the heap, removed whatever was in the way, took the hand, grabbed the arm, freed the head, pulled out the body, and a few seconds later dragged into the darkness of the sunken road a man who was inanimate, or at least senseless. It was a cuirassier, an officer, even an officer of some rank. A big gold epaulet poked out from beneath his cuirass. This officer no longer had a helmet. A furious cut of the sword had slashed his face, and you could not see it for blood. Yet it didn't look like he had any broken limbs, and by a stroke of luck, if we may use such a term here, the bodies had arched above him in such a way as to prevent him from being crushed. His eyes were closed. He had on his cuirass the silver cross of the Légion d'honneur. The prowler ripped the cross off, and it disappeared into one of the gaping holes of his greatcoat. After that he felt around in the officer's fob pocket, felt a watch in it, and took it. Then he fumbled in the waistcoat, found a purse there, and pocketed it. As he reached this phase in the assistance he was offering the dying man, the officer opened his eyes. "Thank you," he said feebly. The roughness of the man handling him, the freshness of the night, the fact of being able to breathe freely, had brought him to his senses. The prowler did not answer. He raised his head. The sound of footfalls could be heard on the plain, probably some patrol approaching. The officer murmured, for there was still agony in his voice, "Who won the battle?" "The English," replied the prowler. The officer went on, "Look in my pockets. You'll find a purse and a watch. Take them." This had already been done. The prowler pretended to do what he was told and said, "There's nothing there." "I've been robbed," the officer went on. "I'm so sorry. You could have had them." The tread of the patrol was becoming more and more distinct. "Someone's coming," said the prowler, making a move as though to go. The officer, painfully raising his arm, held him back.
"You've saved my life. Who are you?"
The prowler replied fast and low, "I was, like you, in the French army. I must leave you. If they catch me, they'll shoot me. I've saved your life. Now you're on your own."
"What's your rank?"
"Sergeant."
"What's your name?"
"Thénardier."
"I won't forget that name,"
said the officer.
"And you remember mine. My name is Pontmercy."
Book 2. The Ship Orion. Number 24601 becomes number 9430. Jean Valjean was nabbed again. You will be grateful to us for passing rapidly over these painful details. We will restrict ourselves to transcribing two short pieces published in the newspapers of the day, a few months after the surprising events that occurred in Montreuil-sur-Mer. These articles are a little perfunctory. You will recall that there was no Gazette des Tribunaux yet at the time. We have taken the first from the Drapeau Blanc. It is dated July 25, 1823. An arrondissement of the Pas-de-Calais has just seen an event out of the ordinary. Some years back, a stranger to that département, a man named Monsieur Madeleine, had revived an old local industry, the manufacture of jet and black glass beads, thanks to new processes. He made his fortune doing so, and, we must say, that of the district. In recognition of his services, he was appointed mayor. The police have discovered that this Monsieur Madeleine was none other than an ex-convict in breach of ban, sentenced in 1796 for robbery and named Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean has been sent back to jail. It seems that prior to his arrest, he had managed to withdraw from Monsieur Lafitte's bank a sum of more than 500,000, which he had invested there and which he had earned, furthermore, perfectly legitimately, they say, through his business. It is not known where Jean Valjean has hidden this sum since his return to Toulon jail. The second article, a bit more detailed, is taken from the Journal de Paris, same date. A freed ex-convict named Jean Valjean has just appeared before the circuit court of the Var in circumstances made to attract attention. This rogue had managed to outwit the vigilance of the police. He had changed his name and succeeded in getting himself appointed as mayor of one of our little northern towns. He had set up in that town a fairly considerable business. He was at last unmasked and arrested, thanks to the indefatigable zeal of the public prosecutor's department. He had as concubine a streetwalker who died of shock at the moment of his arrest. This miserable wretch, who is endowed with Herculean strength, found the means to escape, but 3 or 4 days after said escape, the police once more got their hands on him, in Paris itself, just as he was climbing up into one of those little cabs that ply between the capital and the village of Montfermeil. Sine was. They say he took advantage of the interval of those 3 or 4 days of freedom to withdraw a considerable sum placed by him with one of our leading bankers. This sum is estimated at 600,000 or 700,000 francs. According to the bill of indictment, he has buried it in a place known only to himself, and it has not been possible to seize it. Whatever the case may be, the said Jean Valjean has just been brought before the circuit court of the département of the Var, charged with committing highway robbery under arms about 8 years ago on the person of one of those honest children who, as the patriarch of Ferney has written in immortal verse, arrive every year from Savoy, their hands lightly wiping long chimneys thick with soot. This bandit renounced any self-defense. It has been proved, through the able and eloquent mouthpiece of the public prosecutor's office, that the robbery was committed in collaboration and that Jean Valjean was part of a gang of thieves in the Midi. Consequently, Jean Valjean, being found guilty, has been given the death sentence. This criminal refused to take his case to the final court of appeal. The king, in his inexhaustible clemency, has deigned to commute his sentence to that of hard labor in perpetuity. Jean Valjean was immediately sent to Toulon jail. It was not forgotten that Jean Valjean had religious habits at Montreuil-sur-Mer. A few newspapers, among others the Constitutionnel, presented this commutation as a triumph for the clerical party. Jean Valjean changed numbers in jail. He became known as 9430. For the rest, we might as well get it off our chests now, once and for all, that, along with Monsieur Madeleine, the prosperity of Montreuil-sur-Mer disappeared. All he had foreseen during his long dark night of the soul came to pass. With him gone, the soul was gone, in fact. After his fall, what happened at Montreuil-sur-Mer was the usual self-interested divvying up of what is left when great men fall. That fatal carving up of flourishing enterprises that takes place out of sight daily in the human community, and that history has noted only once, because it happened to occur after the death of Alexander the Great. Do tenants have themselves crowned kings? Foremen play at being manufacturers? Envious rivalries rear their ugly heads. The vast workshops of Monsieur Madeleine were shut down. The buildings fell into ruin. The workers scattered. Some left the area, others left the trade. From that day forth, everything was done on a small scale instead of on a large scale, for the lucre instead of for the common good. No more center. Everywhere competition and ruthlessness. Monsieur Madeleine used to dominate everything and provide direction. With him fallen, it was every man for himself. The fighting spirit took over from the spirit of organization. Harshness from cordiality. The hate of each against all from the benevolence of the founder of all. The bonds knitted by Monsieur Madeleine became tangled and broke. Processes were rigged, products debased, confidence killed off. Markets diminished, fewer orders were placed, wages dropped, workshops stopped work, bankruptcy ensued. After that, nothing left for the poor. Everything fell apart. Even the state realized that someone had been crushed somewhere. Less than 4 years after the circuit court decree establishing, for the benefit of the galleys, that Monsieur Madeleine and Jean Valjean were one and the same, taxes were doubled in the district of Montreuil-sur-Mer, and Monsieur de Villèle addressed the house to that effect in the month of February 1827. In which you will read two lines of verse that are perhaps the devil's. Before we go any further, it would be appropriate to recount in some detail a weird incident that happened at Montfermeil around the same time, and that may not be purely coincidental to certain conjectures of the public prosecutor's department. There is, in the region of Montfermeil, a very ancient superstition, all the more curious and all the more precious, since a popular superstition in the Paris environs is like an aloe vera plant in Siberia. We are among those who respect anything that smacks of the rare plant. So here is the Montfermeil superstition. The locals believe that the devil has, from time immemorial, chosen the forest to hide his treasures in. The good women there claim that it is not rare, at the end of day, in remote places in the woods, to meet a black man with the look of a carter or a woodcutter, shod in clogs, decked out in breeches and a frock of coarse canvas cloth, who is recognizable in that, instead of a cap or hat, he has two immense horns on his head. This would indeed make him fairly recognizable. This man is usually busy digging a hole. There are three ways of dealing with coming across him. The first is to approach the man and speak to him. Then you realize the man is nothing more than a peasant, that he looks black because it is dusk, that he's not digging a hole at all, but cutting the grass for his cows, and that what you took for horns is nothing more than a manure fork he carries on his back, whose prongs only seemed to sprout out of his head because of the perspective offered by the fading light. You go back home and you die before the week is out. The second approach is to observe him. Wait till he has dug his hole, till he has covered it over and gone on his way, then to run quickly to the ditch, open it up again, and take out the treasure that the black man has obviously put there. In this case, you die before the month is out. Lastly, the third approach is to not speak to the black man, to not even look at him, and to take off as fast as your legs will carry you. You die before the year is out. As all three methods have their drawbacks, the second, which offers at least some advantages, among others that of owning a treasure, if only for a month, is the one generally adopted. Hardy types, who can't resist a gamble, have thereby often enough, we are assured, opened up the holes dug by the black man and tried to rob the devil. It seems the operation is fairly hopeless, at least if we are to believe the tradition, and in particular the two enigmatic lines in barbaric Latin that a bad Norman monk named Trifon, who was a bit of a wizard, has left us on the subject. This Trifon is buried in the abbey of Saint-Georges de Beauchaville, near Rouen, and toads breed on his grave. So you go to enormous trouble, for these particular holes are normally very deep. You sweat, you root around, you toil away all night, for this is done at night. Your shirt gets soaked, your candle burns out, you damage your pickaxe, and when at last you get to the bottom of the hole, when you lay your hand on the treasure, what do you find? What is the devil's treasure? A sou, sometimes an écu, a stone, a skeleton, a bloody corpse, sometimes a ghost folded in four like a sheet of paper in a wallet, sometimes nothing. This is what Tuyfon's couplet seems to announce to the indiscreetly curious. Dig, and in the hole find dark treasure buried, paltry coins, stones, corpses, ghosts, worthless things. It seems that these days you also find there either a powder horn with bullets, or an old pack of greasy, scorched cards that has obviously been used by devils. Truffaut does not record the two last findings, given that Truffaut lived in the 12th century, and it does not appear that the devil had the wit to invent gunpowder before Roger Bacon, or cards before Charles Lessis. For the rest, if you play with these cards, you are sure to lose everything you own, and as for the powder in the powder horn, it has the property of making your gun go off in your face. Well, very shortly after the period when the public prosecutor's department decided the freed convict Jean Valjean had been prowling around Montfermeil during the few days he was on the run, it was remarked in this same village that a certain old road mender named Boulatruelle was taken with the woods. People in the area claimed to know that this Boulatruelle had been in jail. He was subject to occasional police surveillance, and, as he could not find work anywhere, the local council employed him at a pittance as a road mender on the crossroad from Gagny to Lagny. This Boulatruelle was looked down on by the people of the district. Too respectful, too humble, too quick to doff his cap at everyone, quivering and smiling in front of the gendarme, probably affiliated with gangs of bandits, people said, suspected of ambushes at the edge of copses at nightfall. The only thing going for him was that he was a drunk. This is what people thought they had noted. For some little time, Boulatruelle had been leaving his job of stone lining and road maintenance extremely early and going off into the forest with his pickaxe. You would come across him round about evening in the most deserted clearings, in the wildest thickets, looking for all the world as if he was searching for something, sometimes digging holes. The good women who passed by took him for Beelzebub, then they recognized Boulatruelle and were scarcely more reassured. These encounters seemed to really throw Boulatruelle. It was obvious that he was trying to hide, and that there was some mystery in what he was up to. They said in the village, "It's clear the devil has made an appearance. Boulatruelle saw him and he's searching. Truth is, he's just the man to get his hands on Lucifer's stash." The Voltairians added, "Will Boulatruelle catch the devil, or will the devil catch Boulatruelle?" The old women crossed themselves a lot. But Boulatruelle's shenanigans in the woods stopped, and he went back to his regular hours as a roadmender. People moved on to other things. A few people, though, remained curious, thinking that what might be involved in the whole business was not the fabulous treasure of legend, but a real windfall, a lot more serious and substantial than the devil's banknotes, and whose secret Boulatruelle had half gleaned. The most intrigued were the schoolmaster and Thénardier, the keeper of the low-class inn, who was everybody's friend, but who had not deigned to make friends with Boulatruelle. "He was in the galleys, eh?" said Thénardier. "Christ, a person doesn't know who's coming or going when it comes to the clink." One night the schoolmaster remarked that once upon a time the law would have looked into what Boulatruelle was up to in the woods, and he would have had to talk whether he liked it or not, that they would have used torture on him if need be, and that Boulatruelle would not have stood up to it if, for example, they'd used water torture. "Give him the booze treatment," said Thénardier. They got together and plied the old roadmender with drink. Boulatruelle drank enormously and said little. With admirable art and a masterly sense of proportion, he combined the thirst of a greedy pig with the discretion of a judge. Yet by dint of returning to the charge and by piecing things together and wringing out of him the few obscure words he inadvertently let slip, this is what Thénardier and the schoolmaster thought they understood. One morning, Boulatruelle turned up for work at daybreak and was surprised to see in a corner of the woods, under a bush, a shovel and a pickaxe that you'd have to say had been hidden. But it seems he thought that it was probably the shovel and pickaxe of old Six Fours, the water carrier, and thought no more about it. But the evening of the same day, he apparently saw, without himself being seen, as he was hidden by a big tree, heading off the road to the thickest part of the wood, an individual who was in no way from round these parts, and that he, Boulatruelle, knew very well. Translation, courtesy of Thénardier. A pal from the clink. Boulatruelle had obstinately refused to say who the man was. This individual was carrying a bundle, something square like a big box or a small chest. Surprise on the part of Boulatruelle. Yet it wasn't for 6 or 7 minutes, it seems, that the idea of following the individual came to him. By then it was too late. The individual was already in the thicket. Night had fallen, and Boulatruelle wasn't able to get to him. So he decided to keep his eye on the edge of the woods. There was a moon. 2 or 3 hours later, Boulatruelle saw his individual emerge from the thicket, now carrying not the small chest, but a pickaxe and a shovel. Boulatruelle had let the individual pass, and it didn't occur to him to approach him because he told himself the other man was 3 times as strong as he was, and armed with a pickaxe, and would probably whack him when he saw who he was and figured out that he'd been recognized. Touching effusions of 2 old chums who run into each other suddenly. But the shovel and pickaxe had been a flash of light for Boulatruelle. He ran off into the bushes the next morning, but he didn't find either the shovel or the pickaxe. He concluded that this individual, after entering the wood, had dug a hole with the pickaxe, had buried the chest in it, and had filled the hole in with the shovel. Now, the chest was too small to contain a dead body, so it had to contain money. Hence his investigations. Boulatruelle had explored, probed, and poked around the whole forest and rooted around wherever the ground looked freshly disturbed to him. In vain. He hadn't dug up a thing. No one thought any more about it in Montfermeil. There were just a few die-hard rumor-mongers who said, "You can be certain that the roadmender from Gagny didn't root around like that for nothing. The devil's come. Nothing surer." How the chain on the shackles must have undergone preparatory treatment to be shattered like that with one whack of the hammer. Toward the end of October of that same year, 1823, the inhabitants of Toulon saw the ship Orion sail back into their port to have some damage repaired following a bout of rough weather. The Orion was later employed in Brest as a training ship, but at the time it was part of the Mediterranean squadron. This vessel, disabled as it was, for the sea had treated it badly, made quite an impression when it limped into harbor. It was bearing some flag or other, I can't remember which, that earned it a regulation 11-gun salute, returned by it blast for blast, making 22 in all. It has been estimated that in salvos, royal and military shows of politeness, exchanges of courteous din, signals of etiquette, formalities of harbor and citadel, sunrises and sunsets saluted daily by all the fortresses and all the warships, openings and closings of gates, etc., etc., the civilized world all over the globe fires off 150,000 pointless cannon shots every 24 hours. At 6 francs a shot, that means that 900,000 francs a day, or 300 million a year, goes up in smoke. This is just a detail, and while this is going on, the poor are dying of hunger. The year 1823 was what the Restoration called the time of the war with Spain. This war was actually many events rolled into one, with plenty of singularities thrown in for good measure. A big family affair for the Bourbons, the French branch aiding and protecting the branch in Madrid, in other words, performing an act of seniority. An apparent return to our national traditions, complicated by subservience and cringing to the state cabinets of the North. Monsieur le Duc d'Angoulême, dubbed by the liberal rags the hero of Andujar, cracking down with a triumphal attitude somewhat contradicted by his peaceful air on the old and very real terrorism of the Holy Office, as it grappled with the chimerical terrorism of the liberals. The sans-culottes, resurrected to the great alarm of the dowagers under the name of descamisados, monarchists striving to impede progress, which they called anarchy. The theories of 89 nipped in the bud suddenly, a European woe putting a stop to the French idea making its world tour. Alongside the Generalissimo son of France, the Prince de Carignan, subsequently Charles Albert, enlisting in this crusade of kings against peoples as a volunteer with the red wool epaulets of a grenadier. The soldiers of the Empire again going on campaign, though after 8 years off, aged, sad, and under the white cockade. The tricolor flag waved around by a heroic handful of Frenchmen, just as the white flag had once been in Koblenz 30 years previously. Monks blending in with our troops. The spirit of liberty and novelty made to see reason at the end of a bayonet. Principles brought down by cannon shot. France undoing with its arms what it had done with its spirit. To top it off, the enemy chiefs sold out. The soldiers hesitant, towns under siege by the teeming millions. No military dangers, and yet potential explosions, as with any mine surprised and invaded. Little blood shed, little honor won. Shame for some, glory for none. Such was this war made by princes who were descended from Louis XIV and led by generals who sprang from Napoleon. It had the sad fate of recalling neither great war nor great politics. A few feats of arms were serious. The taking of the Trocadero, for example, was a fine military campaign. But on the whole, we repeat, the trumpets of this war produced a tinny sound. The ensemble was suspect, and history backs France in her difficulty in accepting this false triumph. It seemed obvious that certain Spanish officers tasked with resisting yielded too easily. The whiff of corruption was given off by the victory. It felt as if it was more a case of the generals having been won than the battles. And the victorious soldier went home, humiliated. A demeaning war, indeed. One in which you could read Banque de France between the folds of the flag. The soldiers of the War of 1808, on top of whom Saragossa had so alarmingly collapsed, frowned darkly in 1823 when confronted by the easy sacking of citadels, and took to regretting Palafox. It is in the nature of France to prefer facing Rostopchin rather than Ballesteros. From an even graver point of view, something it is only right to insist on, this war, which rubbed France's military spirit up the wrong way, outraged the democratic spirit. It was a bid for enslavement. In this campaign, the goal of the French soldier, that son of democracy, was to put others under the yoke. Nasty nonsense. France is made to stir people's souls, not smother them. Since 1792, all the revolutions of Europe have been the French Revolution. Liberty shines out of France. It is a question of the sun. Anyone who does not see it is blind. Bonaparte said so. The War of 1823, an attack on the generous Spanish nation, was thus at the same time an attack on the French Revolution. This monstrous assault and battery was committed by France, by force. For aside from wars of liberation, all that armies do, they do by force. The term passive obedience says it all. An army is a strange compound masterpiece in which force results from an enormous sum of impotence. This explains war made by humanity against humanity, in spite of humanity. As for the Bourbons, the War of 1823 was fatal for them. They mistook it for a success. They did not see the danger in killing an idea with a slogan. In their naivete, they got things so wrong they introduced into their program, as an element of strength, the enormous weakness of a crime. The spirit of ambush entered into their policy-making. The year 1823 sowed the seeds of 1830. In their debates, the Spanish campaign became an argument for violent shows of strength and for the shenanigans of divine right. Having re-established El Rey Neto, In Spain, France could certainly re-establish the absolute monarch on home turf. They fell into the frightening error of mistaking the soldier's obedience for the nation's consent. That kind of confidence loses thrones. It doesn't do to fall asleep either in the shade of the poisonous manchineel tree or in the shadow of an army. But let's get back to the good ship Orion. During the maneuvers of the Generalissimo Prince's army, a squadron was cruising the Mediterranean. As we have just said, the Orion was part of this squadron, and it had been driven back into the port of Toulon by rough seas. The presence of a warship in a port has something indefinable that pulls the crowds and fills them with wonder. This is because it's big, and crowds love anything big. A ship of the line is one of the most magnificent encounters between the power of nature and the genius of man. A ship of the line is composed of both the heaviest and the lightest of materials, because it is tied to three forms of substance at once, solid, liquid, and gas, and has to fight against all three. It has 11 iron claws to seize granite at the bottom of the sea, and more wings and antennae than a winged arthropod to catch the wind in the clouds. Its breath comes out of its 120 guns, as if through enormous bugles, and proudly answers thunder back. The ocean tries to lead it astray with the frightening sameness of its waves, but the vessel has its soul, its compass, which counsels it and always shows it true north. On black nights, its lanterns make up for the stars. And so, against the wind, it has rope and canvas, against water, wood, against rock, iron, copper, and lead, against the darkness, light, and against the vastness, a needle. If you want to get an idea of all the gigantic proportions that come together to make up a ship of the line, you only have to duck under one of the covered slipways, six stories high, of the ports of Brest or Toulon. Ships being built there sit under a bell jar, so to speak. This colossal beam is a yard. That great wood column stretching along the ground as far as the eye can see is the mainmast. Measuring from its roots in the slipway to its crown in the clouds, it is 60 fathoms high, and it is 3 feet in diameter at its base. The English mainmast rises 217 feet above the waterline. The navy of our father's day used cables. Nowadays we use chains. Just the simple coil of chains of a 100-gun ship is 4 feet high, 20 feet wide, and 8 feet deep. And to build such a ship, how much wood do you need? 3,000 steers, or cubic meters. It is a floating forest. And then again, take note, what we are talking about here is merely a military craft of 40 years ago, a simple sailing ship. Steam, then in its infancy, has since added new miracles to this prodigy known as a warship. At the present day, for example, the hybrid ship with propeller is an amazing machine hauled along by sails 3,000 square meters in surface and by a 2,500-horsepower boiler. Forgetting about these new marvels, the old ship of Christopher Columbus and of De Ruyter is one of man's great masterpieces. It is as inexhaustible in power as the infinite is in gusts of wind. It stores the wind in its sails. It is a fixed point in the endlessly spreading waves. It floats, and it rains. But the moment comes when a squall snaps this 60-foot yard like a piece of straw, when the wind bends that 400-foot-high mast like a reed, when that anchor, weighing 10,000 pounds, is twisted in the maw of the waves like an angler's hook in the jaws of a pike, when those monster guns let out plaintive and futile roars that the hurricane carries into the void and into the darkness, when all this power and all this majesty are engulfed by a superior power and majesty. Every time immense strength is deployed only to end in immense weakness, it makes people think. This is why the curious abound in seaports, without themselves being all that clear why they are there, thronging around these marvelous machines of war and navigation. Every day, then, from morning to night, the quays, piers, and jetties of the port of Toulon were crawling with idlers and peep